On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to make the case for our MVP favorites, including Jokic, Giannis, Steph, and Wembanyama. That's right. Plus, Russell Westbrook signs a deal with Sacramento, but does he really fit in with the rest of the Kings roster? All this coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, I am joined by our man, your man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, I am excited. I survived a camping trip with my children this weekend. You know, not a training camp trip, camping camp trip. Hiking and backpacking and rain and s'mores and all sorts of things, campfires. No falling down mountains while backpack hiking. No getting burned in fires. Successfully returned back to Brooklyn. I'm here. I'm good to go. I'm feeling pumped. I'm feeling energized. I'm feeling excited to be back where there's electricity so that I can do this show with you. And Tom, I'm ready to put up some numbers. So why don't you hit me with it? What is our big number for this week?
Dan, this week's big number is 13. That's the number of post-ups we've seen already from Victor Wembanyama this preseason, which I gotta tell you, it's the number one number in the NBA this preseason. No player has more post-ups than Victor Wembanyama, according to Synergy Sports Tracking. You might be asking yourself, Dan, and the rest of you out there listening, you might be asking yourself, why do I care? Yeah, he's the tallest guy in the NBA. Yet, so what if he's averaging the most post-ups in the league? Well, the answer there is that he hasn't done this before. He is a guy last season that, according to Synergy Sports, he ranked 19th in post-ups per game. 19th. And so the fact that he's doing this more than anybody this preseason is very notable. And it's a big reason why, Dan, I am ready to say here on this show, on this program, Dan, that I think he's going to win MVP this year. Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
This number right here is a big reason why 13, I am picking
13 post-ups has you ready to make that call.
Because he's very big.
True.
And he's playing like it. And I know what people are thinking. Okay. He's 21 years old. The Spurs aren't ready yet. If he does put up huge numbers like he did last year, it didn't end up in any sort of MVP talk, but I would posit that this is the year. This is the year. He's got the story. Okay. Coming back from DVT, had his season ended short last year. He went to go to meet with Shaolin Temple and some monks. Really cool. He traveled to Tokyo. He traveled to Costa Rica and did some soccer crazy stuff that like 7'7" guys shouldn't be doing. And I did say 7'7".
You did. I noticed that. Now, why would you say 7'7", Tom?
Last year, his listed height was 7'3", and this year I think it's moved to 7'5".
Yep, 7'5".
Why are we pretending that he's 7'5"? He's not 7'5", Dan. Dude's 7'7". Why are we protecting this like it's a state secret, right? That Victor Wembanyama, like you look at what he, like when he's out there onto the floor with another 7-footer, just towers over him. It's not a question in my mind. We had on Basketball Illuminati this week, we had Michael C. Wright, who's our friend over at ESPN.com that's been covering Wemby for ESPN. And he joked with the Spurs, was like, are we really still lying about his height, that he was 7'3" last year? And they were like, you know, they you know, kind of laughed it off. Dude, 7'7". Dan. Yeah,
I mean, no less a source than Boban Marjanovic went on NBA Today on ESPN. Boban listed at 7'4" during his playing career, which includes last year when he was in Houston. They did play against San Antonio earlier in the season. They were both on the court together. Boban said he was looking up at Wemby last year. So 7'4" looking up at Wemby last year before they increased the listed height. So very
seven
possible.
7'3". Yeah, right. Come on. You know,
and so he would be, if that's true, he would be the third 7'7" dude in NBA history. George Mirasan, Manute Bol, and Victor Wembanyama. Two MVPs, as I recall.
Right. And the thing about Wemby last year was he almost seemed like he was trying to be like Steph. And this summer, he went from dropping like a bunch of deep threes last season to the tune of 8.8 three-pointers a game. The season before that, his rookie season, he was at like 5.5 threes per game. In this preseason, he's averaging 4.4 three-point attempts per 36 minutes. And I believe it. I think this is what we're going to see is Wemby not just post up a lot more, but also lower his volume, his shot diet from way downtown. I don't think it's a coincidence, Dan, that Wemby is not only leading the league in post-ups this preseason. Yes, preseason caveats apply, et cetera.
Sure.
But we just saw him go to the Dream Shake Academy, Hakeem Olajuwon, which Mike C. Wright wrote a great piece detailing all of this. Talked to Hakeem Olajuwon and about his time working with Wemby. And I kind of feel like something clicked in Wemby's amazing brain. That he has. He has a very curious mind and he has this intellectual framework that he's operating from. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he's playing in the paint more. He went to school with Hakeem the Dream and learned the Dream Shake in like 2.5 seconds. And he's taking fewer three-pointers. And then when you watch what Mitch Johnson is doing this preseason as the first season as a full-time official head coach taking over for Pop last season, and being installed as the official first-time head coach, I think we have to pay attention to he's operating as a hub a la Domantas Sabonis, a la Nikola Jokic, a la Alperen Şengün at that high post on the elbow and moving and being the fulcrum of the offense that way in ways that last year he did it a little bit. Again, 19th in post-ups per game. This season, it seems like this is a real focal point. And I think Wemby is better suited in this role because of his height to be closer to the basket where he's one drop step away from dunking it on your head. And so many times this preseason, dude, like Isaiah Jackson looks like he's my height. Like what he did to Isaiah Jackson against the Pacers the other night was frankly disrespectful. Like the things that he was lowering his shoulder and sending Isaiah Jackson to the front row. There was one time where Isaiah Jackson did this juke where he totally shook Wemby out of his shoes. And then Wemby quickly recovered and beat him to the spot. And then Isaiah could do nothing but fall to the ground when he was engulfed by Victor Wembanyama's like 8,000-foot wingspan. So I'm looking at the stats. I'm looking at the impact. I'm looking at the story. And I'm saying to myself, what am I missing here? I feel like the tide is pulling out before a tsunami. And it is going to arrive on the shores of the NBA here. And I'm ready. I'm ready for the Victor Wembanyama takeover. And I think it's arrived because he is finally playing like he's 7'7", like he actually is, Dan.
All right. I love this energy. I love your excitement. I love the positivity. I'm going to give you two numbers that support the positivity and one that might bring that tide back toward the shore. All right.
Okay.
So one, you mentioned the cutting down of the three-point shots. From the great John Schumann at NBA.com, he noted over the summer, Wembanyama took only 37% of his shots inside last season, down from 51% in his rookie season. So far in the preseason, 24 of his 35 shots in the paint, that's 68.6%. So to your point, nearly double his shots inside as opposed to where it was last year. Clear point of emphasis with the added strength and the work that he put in this offseason. You mentioned operating more in the post, more as a Şengün Jokic-like hub, somebody that's going to handle the ball at the elbows or the mid-post and be able to facilitate from there. Last season, Victor Wembanyama, per 36 minutes of floor time, 4 assists. Through 4 preseason games, per 36 minutes, 8.7 assists. Yeah. 36 minutes. So again, we don't have like touch time data and stuff like that right now for the preseason games, or at least not publicly available through ESPN, NBA stat coverage, but clearly an emphasis on get him the ball, let him facilitate more, and clearly pretty skilled at doing it. So in theory, you think about what would that extrapolate to? More interior shots, more facilitation from the post. Now the numbers start to be like higher percentage shots, more points per game, more frequent assist opportunities. You're counting stats and all the advanced stats that go with it continue to go up and up and up. Here's the cold drink of water here, the dousing of this.
is that I like a good cold plunge. So give it to right, me.
The cold plunge here. Yeah. It's a little bit polar berry. 58.8 is my counter number. That's the average number of wins for the team that produced the MVP over the last 10 seasons. Okay. And now maybe you're saying, okay, 10 seasons, right? That includes 73-9, right? So maybe that tilts the math. Let's say widen the aperture, make it a larger sample, go 20 seasons. It goes up to 60.2.
Sure.
So generally speaking, if your team's not in the mid to high 50s, you're not even really going to be in the conversation on the top of that MVP ballot. The two caveats there, the two outliers, Russ 2016-17, when he becomes the first player to average a triple-double since Oscar Robertson, and Jokic in 21-22 when the Nuggets had no Jamal Murray, barely had MPJ, and he carries them to 48 wins while also having the highest PER in the history of the league, higher than Wilt. So if you're going to be at the top of that MVP kind of conversation, you need to either be mid to high 50s or better in win total, or such a statistical outlier that you overwhelm even the other statistical outliers at the top of the league, which includes Nikola Jokic, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Luka Doncic. I'm excited for your excitement.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you really think Victor Wembanyama can do one or both of those things this season?
Absolutely. I am fully on board with this other stat here, which is, yes, 58 is the average number of wins that an MVP needs to have, or the average benchmark for an MVP winner. I would counter with 7. The number of wins increased by that team in that MVP season, meaning it's not just the number of wins you have, your team has, it's that you surprised people or improved upon your over-unders and the story involved with that. And I think when the bar for the San Antonio Spurs, help me out here, the over-under on the San Antonio Spurs this season is what, like 46.5, I want to say?
Give me one second.
This is great podcasting here, making sure that one of my strongest talking points, I'm going to have the number here on a show called The Big Number. Well, How big is this number, the over-under on BetMGM?
Lucky for you, as the person that wrote the San Antonio Spurs season preview for Yahoo Sports, I also had to go look it up. 44.5.
Dan, it's right there. If he wins seven, if the Spurs win 7 more games than their over-under, like I just said, the average average number of wins increased by an MVP winner. Like what I meant to say was the over-under was beaten by average of 7 wins.
How much they exceeded their preseason over-under number.
That's right. So last year, the over-under for the Oklahoma City Thunder was 57.5, and they won 68 games.
Jeez, bonkers.
Yes, they won 68 games, and yes, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was great, but I think the story of him leading this team way beyond expectations, I think was a big chunk of that push for MVP in ways that the Denver Nuggets and the Oklahoma City Thunder are not going to have the same kind of upside from that perspective of like blowing our socks off and exceeding expectations. Like, where did this come from? I think the Spurs have the highest upside, you know, potential in that sense, is that if they're over-unders at 44.5 and they win 50 games in the Western Conference, because here's the thing, Dan. Last year, we agreed that right before he got diagnosed with the blood clot, the DVT, he was the leading guy for Defensive Player of the Year. He led the league in blocks per game at 3.8. It was the consensus Defensive Player of the Year. How much more do we need to see offensively for us to think like, all right, if you're the best player defensively, how good do you have to be offensively for us to be like, yeah, that's the MVP of the league. That's the MVP. He averaged 24, 11, and 4 last year. 4 assists a game, 3.7 to be exact. If he's going to get up to like 5, 6, 7, 8 assists per game because he's going to be a hub, and yes, he's got to knock down those turnovers, a lot of these like weird passes where he's being way too fancy, trying to go behind the back, no look in the preseason, I get it. But if he ups that, the assist numbers to like 5 or 6 or 7, get some triple doubles up on his resume, I kind of feel like the MVP train is going to be full steam ahead. And so if we already are willing to say he's the best defensive player, best defensive presence in the NBA, and he's also averaging 24, 11, and 5, call it 25, 26 points per game, and then 5-6. I just feel like this is, right now, BetMGM has him at plus 1,200 odds to win MVP, fifth shortest odds in the NBA behind, like you said, SGA, Jokic, Giannis. I think, is Luka ahead of him on there too?
Yep. I think Luka's third.
Yeah. I just feel like, man, there's a lot of value there, that as this season progresses, De'Aaron Fox comes back to the squad and they're healthy. I just feel like this team is poised to make the leap this year with Dylan Harper, coming into the squad. Yes, he's a rookie, but I'm very bullish on the Spurs. And maybe I was a little too early last year saying that I'm predicting, hot take, that he was going to win MVP. And maybe this is just doubling down on that aggressive take last year. I just think Wemby's that good. He's 7'7" and he's showing a lot of guard skills, and he's playing back to the basket, and he's doing much stronger, playing bully ball a lot more. I think he knows he's this good. And I think that's scary for the rest of the league.
Yeah. And you know, that some of what he said since, in his public comments since returning from the deep vein thrombosis, was basically like, that is a literal and figurative, you face your basketball mortality kind of moment, and saying like, I know I can't wait. Like, I have to go after what I want right now. And certainly he occupied his summer with that kind of pursuit. And listen, I have no argument against Victor Wembanyama being this good. That's certain. Like, I think it is absolutely possible he's 26, 11, 5 blocks. Like, I think it's entirely possible that that's what we see from him. My reluctance on this is solely about, if you do that and you win 45 games in the West,
that's gonna be tough.
And you are having to go over and above, like head and shoulders above in that context. If your team success is at that level, you've got a statistically and wow factor and, you know, Heisman highlight reel moments and that kind of stuff over and above those guys that are already there. And that is just such a high bar to reach. That said, I mean, especially, and I think the other thing, like, you know, the nuts and bolts function of it, you said, how good does he have to be on offense? To me, it's, again, it's not as much how does he have to be. You're talking about a team where the shooting is a real concern. They finished 20th in offensive efficiency last season. They just lost Chris Paul, and they didn't really add a ton of, like, shot of shooting to that. They have a bunch of shot creation in a lot of these young guards, but I think it's going to be a real question, especially if Wembanyama is playing closer to the basket, not the unicorn floor spacer, and you've got De'Aaron Fox hit or miss on the jumper, you've got Stephen Castle hit or miss on the jumper, Dylan Harper hit or miss on the jumper, you're relying a lot on like Devin Vassell, Harrison Barnes, Julian Champagne, and then like, I don't know, Lindy Waters, Kelly Olynyk, yeah, to space, baby, the floor there. So the offensive ecosystem, if they're like the 18th best offense in the NBA, even with him putting up those numbers, and they only win in the mid 40s, that to me is just a tougher sell for for the top of the ballot. Fifth, fourth, I can see that absolutely. I think that there's a completely legitimate chance for that. All the way up to the top, though, I think is difficult just because of who he's going to have to leapfrog to get there. Now, granted, 7'7" guys can leap an awful long way.
Yep.
So it's certainly possible, but that to me, I think I still got to kind of see that to believe it.
Yeah, man, sometimes I just feel like we overthink this, and it's like, dude, 7'7" and he's going to average like close to 30, 12, 5-5. And it's just like, at what point are we just like, all right, if they win 47 games, we saw Russell Westbrook win an MVP doing that. We saw Nikola Jokic win the MVP doing just about that. I think they won 48 games or something like that when 48. He won it. I think the tide is turning on MVP criteria in terms of the number of wins your team has to have for you to be eligible or in that conversation. And I think Wemby would benefit from the storyline of him coming back from a really scary career-threatening, life-threatening diagnosis last year. And I do think that there's a much better core here with San Antonio. And Mitch Johnson has a full summer and a training camp to install his offense in his image, what he wants to do. And I think you're seeing in the preseason that Wemby is ready. He's ready to take over, and I think we're going to see it this season. We got Russell Westbrook news later in the program. We're going to talk. He just signed, according to ESPN's Shams Charania, with the Sacramento Kings. We're going to talk about that later. I don't think we're going to make him an MVP candidate this year with the Sacramento Kings, but I think you got some other names here, right?
I do. I've got four other things, four other little numbers that we can talk about on the other side of the break.
Awesome. Let's do that. And before we go into the break here, I just want to remind everybody, a reminder. You can watch this show, The Big Number, on Yahoo Sports Network, which is available to stream on leading FAST services. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv, not .com. We're now TV. yahoosports.tv is where you can catch all the shows on your phone or your browser. So go check that out. The Dunker Spot, KOC show. Go check it out on Yahoo Sports Network, yahoosports.tv. Dan, 13, that's the number of post-ups that Victor Wembanyama has had this preseason, which is the highest number in the NBA, according to Synergy Sports. It's a big reason why I think we are going to see a big MVP season from Victor Wembanyama. Time is now. You disagree. That's okay. I'm okay with that. This is a forum at The Big Number that is open to curiosity and expanding our minds. And I think that disagreement is totally healthy. And I want to hear more from you, Dan. Do you have any other numbers that you would like to present as evidence or as support why you think other candidates are a better case to win MVP this season?
Yeah, you gave me the unenviable task of making me argue against the fun one. But you also gave me the opportunity to say you get the field of the other 449 NBA players. So that's, you know, seemed like a fair counterbalance. So our first little number this week, we'll start off at the very top, 0.309. That's how many win shares per 48 minutes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander averaged last season, a season when he won regular season MVP, finals MVP, and the NBA finals for his first championship with the Oklahoma City Thunder. Seven players in NBA history have finished a season over 0.300 win shares per 48. Only three of them are guards. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Stephen Curry in 2015-16, and Michael Jordan, who did it three times. That's the kind of company that SGA has kept this last season. Steph in an MVP year and Michael Jordan. He just won the scoring title too, by the way. That's like a counting stats thing. That's kind of like an easy thing for people to grab onto. He is the leader of an Oklahoma City Thunder team that enters the season with the highest over under win total of any team. I believe it's 62.5. And by far the best odds of winning this year's championship at BetMGM and I think pretty much any other book you can look at. So eye-popping, easy to understand counting stats like leading the league in scoring. Godzilla level advanced numbers on par with those gigantic guys that we see at the top of the running every year. Plus likely the highest team success in the league. Feels like a pretty easy argument to make by that for why SGA would be at least there in the conversation with Wemby, if not head and shoulders above him at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't really disagree with any of that. You know,
it's not as fun to say this, like this thing that just happened is going to happen again. But if you're asking me how to poke holes in it, that still felt like a pretty good place to start. The guy that just won MVP on the team that's favored to win the championship again.
Yeah. And like if Chet doesn't miss half the season and Isaiah Hartenstein doesn't miss a big chunk of the season like they did last year, feels like they could win 70 plus games, in which case it's going to be hard not to pick Shai again as a back to back MVP. Yeah, the over under on their win total, just in terms of like, how are they going to exceed expectations to drive that campaign? Like how much better can they be? And the answer is like, when you're talking about a team as young as they are, just sheer internal development, they could win, chase 73 wins this year. And I don't think many people would be like, yeah, that is totally crazy. They won 68 last year and they were like puppies, you know? So the idea, like there is some wiggle room there with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Of course, after a championship, whether Mark Dagnall just says, hey, let's pull it back a little bit.
Right.
Let's kind of just take things back and not go 35 minutes tonight. Let's just go to, you know, 30 minutes for Shai. And I just feel like, yeah, if there is an argument against Shai doing a repeat, it's that. And there's the Jokic guy too. So,
yeah, I was going to say it's really hard to win back-to-back MVPs, which brings us to our second little number. That's 35. It's how many times in NBA history someone has posted a player efficiency rating or PER north of 30. 35 individual seasons. Nikola Jokic has five of them. That is more than any other player who has ever played the game, which includes guys like Michael Jordan, LeBron James, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, etc. Nikola Jokic is the consensus best player alive. I don't think it's telltales out of school to say that. He is smack in the middle of his prime at age 30. He basically never misses serious time. He's played in fewer than 70 games just once in 10 seasons. And in that season, he played 69 games. He led the Nuggets last season to 50 wins in the 4 seed. And that was like a down season that ended with the coach and GM getting fired. That team, Nikola Jokic led, pushed the Nuggets to the Thunder, rather, to 7 games in the second round, despite by the end of the series, Aaron Gordon playing on one leg, Michael Porter Jr. playing with one shoulder, and the entire bench playing with one Russell Westbrook and basically nothing else but that. The Nuggets should be better this season. They added a bunch of guys to the bench. Jonas Valanciunas, Tim Hardaway Jr., Bruce Brown is back. I love the addition of Cam Johnson for them. We've talked about it. 24 first-round pick Deron Holmes missed his entire rookie season with an Achilles rupture. He's back. They like him. Again, eye-popping, easy-to-understand counting stats. He averaged a triple-double last season, too, by the way. Godzilla advanced numbers. By the way, he averaged a triple-double last season. Godzilla advanced numbers. And again, I think most people have the Nuggets as like right there as the team most likely to unseat Denver, maybe the set number 2 spot in the West. Feels again like Jokic enters the season ahead of Wemby in this conversation.
Yeah, to me, this is, I think he should be the favorite for MVP, like just in terms of betting odds. I think because of the newcomers to the squad, I think they have a lot of narrative going in their favor and also just newness that Jokic hasn't really had a Jonas Valanciunas backing him up in a way that like they could, that second unit, as they've talked about time and time again this preseason in training camp, is like they really want to shore up that second unit so that every time that Jokic steps off the floor, it's not like they're down 20 points. And if that happens, like they are in that 70 win range of if they are able to not just stay afloat in Jokic list lineups, also having some winning stretches there, stints where they're like actually +4 instead of -7 every single night. So Jokic right now, BetMGM has him at +300 and SGA at +260. I'd probably flip those in terms of odds. Jokic, yeah. I guess the question in my head is, will he get the credit and win another MVP? Or will guys like Cam Johnson and Jonas Valanciunas and Bruce Brown actually get the credit there as the newcomers? Not with Bruce, but you get the point.
Yeah.
It's like, will he get the lion's share of the credit there? Because we all acknowledge, like, he's the best player in the game. If he has the right supporting cast, it's just, you know, whether he gets the credit for any sort of improvement this season.
I think the answer to that is yes. I think everybody that we've come to a place where everyone realizes like the Nuggets go as he does. And yes, putting support around him, I don't think will diminish the amount of credit he gets. There's also, you mentioned with Wemby, the story component of like, there's a great story to tell here. This would be Jokic's 4th MVP. That would put him in company of only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Michael Jordan, Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, and LeBron James. Those are the only players that have ever won 4 MVPs. A 4th would put him ahead of Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Moses Malone. So that is a, like, in terms of what the story is, it's like,
getting nauseated by the, does he really deserve a 4th MVP? Because that would mean he's one of 7 people of all time. You're putting him on that pedestal. And it's like, well, he is that good. I mean, if he deserves it, yes, he deserves a 4th MVP. It's insane.
I mean, but that's the thing. Like, I think there was maybe some reluctance to put him in that company a couple of years ago when there was the Embiid versus Jokic argument. And I think the fact that he has continued to like stay at that level, if not ascend, if he remains there, I think that it enters him into a different level of conversation. And I think that's something that could work in his favor there. So that's something to be mindful of. Our third little number is 42.2. And this is a little bit thinner slice, so bear with me. That was Giannis Antetokounmpo's assist percentage at the end of the 2024-25 regular season, the final 11 games. We might remember Damian Lillard, this was before the playoffs, this was before the Achilles rupture. In the regular season, he got ruled out of the March 20th game that the Bucks had against the Lakers. They said at first it was like groin soreness, then it became calf soreness, then it became, oh, there's a blood clot in that calf. And so then that was Dame's out indefinitely. He's out for the rest of the season. And the Bucks was like, man, they're going for the playoffs to try and figure out what to do. They don't really have a great backup point guard on the roster. So Doc Rivers gives the ball to Giannis, which is a pretty good idea. They insert Ryan Rollins into the lineup. He's more of a 3-and-D-E kind of guard. And they said, Giannis, go create. And over those last 11 games, he averages 8.6 assists against just 2.2 turnovers per game. He notched the assist on 42% of his teammates' baskets during that stretch. If that was the full season, that would have been fifth in the NBA behind Trae Young, Jokic, LaMelo Ball, and Cade Cunningham. That is a level of like facilitation and on volume that we've never seen from Giannis. Oh, he also averaged 31 points and 11 rebounds on 61% shooting while doing that facilitation. The Bucks offseason reorganization, we've talked about it on this show, did a lot of things. It did not add a real backup point guard. You know, certainly nobody that can step in like Damian Lillard did. And the idea seems to be point Giannis and surround him with shooters, spread the floor, let him create. If he takes advantage of that opportunity, replicates that late season facilitating while maintaining the scoring, the efficiency, and the rebounding, and the Bucks don't fall apart in the East, they actually stay in that playoff mix. You're talking about a story that would maybe elevate somebody. Maybe that's Giannis. Why would that be Wemby and not Giannis?
Well, you could build the Acropolis with all the ifs that you put in that.
that's true. That is like, true.
There's a lot of ifs that have to go right for Giannis to win MVP. And we discussed, if you want to learn more, listen to last week's episode of The Big Number, because the data shows that this is like bottom five supporting cast for any player in the NBA this year. Like
that carry job, that on-off splits. We talk about that every year. It's part of the Jokic case every year, right?
True. But I think that is, yeah, there's a lot of variance on the Milwaukee Bucks. And if they win 50 games, he's going to have a really strong case. I just think if Wemby wins 50 or his team wins 50 games, I think their voters are more likely to crown Wemby after the offseason he had and the story there, as opposed to giving Giannis another MVP. I think newness and surprise is going to count more for voters. And just, I think fans, I think it will be a really cool story if, you know, in the Western Conference, that team wins 50 games. I think it's going to be a much more impressive figure and accomplishment than in the Eastern Conference, that at the top,
yeah,
there's just going to be wins here left and right. So Giannis, yes, because he's that good, he's going to be in the conversation. I still believe in Wemby.
Yeah, I think that you're right that 50 wins for the Spurs in the West would be a hell of a lot more impressive than 50 wins for the Bucks in the East. I just think the East is more likely than the Spurs doing it in the West. But your point is well taken. Our fourth and final little number this week is 0.655. That was Stephen Curry's true shooting percentage after Jimmy Butler's debut in the Bay Area last season. 655 true shooting percentage. We've talked on this show about how Jimmy's arrival like completely transformed the Warriors. Fourth best record in the NBA, third best net rating, number one defense after the trade deadline for Golden State. They went 28-15 after the trade. That's a 53 win pace. They went 27-8 when they had all of Steph, Jimmy, and Draymond together. That's a 63 win pace. One of the big reasons for that takeoff is that adding another like top shelf creator like Jimmy totally unshackled Steph. 27 points, 5.8 assists, 32.5 minutes a game after Jimmy's debut, 59% on twos, 41% on threes, 92 at the line. That produces a 655 true shooting percentage. I like this one. Steph has hit a 655 true shooting percentage four times in his career, which is bonkers. He has been that or above four times, twice while playing more than 60 games. So, you know, other times he's been injured, missed a chunk of time, and finished like 9th or 10th on the MVP ballot. So two times where he played like a full season, roughly. In those seasons, he finished first and third, respectively, on the MVP ballot. You mentioned that Victor Wembanyama finished fifth in estimated plus minus last season. Stephen Curry finished sixth. Projection models like Kevin Pelton's Shaney, Jeremias Engelman's XRAPM, they seem to like the Warriors and their chances of finishing high in the West a hell of a lot more than they like the Spurs. Mm-hmm. So if that bears out, and if Golden State is a lot better than San Antonio and Steph is Steph during that process, why not Steph?
Dan, you're cooking with gas. I love this take. Did you know that Steph is 14th in MVP odds? 14th behind Trae Young in MVP odds, behind Zion in MVP odds. Right now on BetMGM, it's plus $20,000, which I'm no gambling guru, but if you place a $100 bet, you would win $20,000 if he wins MVP. That, to me, the percentage probability that Steph wins an MVP this year, given what we I've watched because of the Blazers, the two games against the Blazers this season, this preseason, and I love Al Horford blocked Donovan Clingan at the rim in Tuesday night's game, where I was like, he's still doing that? Like, he can still do that?
Can't in lock ways up that Jan I was Hunt like, oh, he's just,
it's preseason, you know. He's not really going to give it. No, Steph looked great on Tuesday night, put up huge numbers, did a lot of the stuff that you'd want to see going into the season. And Jimmy didn't even play. And Jonathan Kuminga got ejected by Rodney Mott in like the second quarter. And so he didn't have him either. So it's like, if Steph and the Warriors approach or threaten to win 60 games this year, man, the MVP campaign is going to be really, really strong for a one Wardell Stephen Curry.
Dude. And you talk about stories, right? Like the proud champion laid low. Everyone threw dirt on him, said like they're not going to be able to come back around. They roar back after the Jimmy trade. They win the first round series against Houston. They're up on Minnesota in game one. It looks like, oh man, they're going to do it again, and they're going to get to the Thunder in the conference finals. Steph pulls his hamstring and it all falls apart. You bring, like, if they're able to carry over that what they did late last season into this season, they keep it going the whole way. Again, we're talking about if. But we're also talking about if with San Antonio.
Yeah, we are.
Yep. So I think there's, if you get to the point where the Warriors are, you know, up in that top two, top three in the West, Steph's healthy the whole way. He produces the way he produced with Jimmy there. I think there'll be a cool story to be able to tell, like, this guy has been at this level this entire time. Throw the flowers for him. So whether that is able to overcome the crowning of Wembanyama, I don't know, maybe not. But if you're asking me to poke some holes, I kind of like the idea of poking one with the guy who hit the shot over Victor Wembanyama in the Olympics to put him to bed, nuit in France.
Yeah. You should have said that all the ifs that I made for Wemby's MVP campaign could have built the Alamo, but you didn't. Now you
or the Eiffel
that.
Tower. I don't know. You can't spell Eiffel without if. I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Dan,
did I just blow your mind real quick?
That was amazing what you just did. Wow. Wow, that was great. That camping trip served you very well, Dan.
I'm refreshed, brother. Look at me. I'm out here.
You're using, you know how Michael Beasley was like, how do you know that you're only using 10% of your brain? You're using way more than 10% of your brain after going on that camping trip. Just opened everything up.
Oh,
you know?
My God. Now I'm just thinking about all the Michael Beasley things over the years. Let's go to break so I can enjoy some of those in the interim, and then we'll come back for the third segment. How about that? Get us out of here, Tom.
Let's do it. I think I might have been converted to the Steph Curry MVP campaign after listening to that.
Boom.
Right after the break, we're going to talk about Russell Westbrook, a former MVP, Russell Westbrook. He signed with an NBA team. Let's talk about it. Dan, we've got breaking news right before we went to air. Russell Westbrook has signed with the Sacramento Kings, according to ESPN's Shams Charania. I think people forget how crazy it is that Russell Westbrook still, age 36, about to turn 37. The dude played for the Sonics. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's an amazing, we see this with Steph, we see it with LeBron, we see it with Al Horford, but Russell Westbrook and how athletic he's been his entire career, it is a testament to his readiness, professionalism, that still at this age, he is able to bring it in a way where you'd expect him to have like a really great three-point shot to keep his longevity in the league. But man, teams love to have Russell Westbrook on their squad, as evidenced by the fact that Sacramento Kings had just signed him. And I've got lots of questions here, but happy for Russ.
Yeah, it felt weird to imagine him not being on a roster for the first time in like 19 years, right? Like that's that the idea of starting a season with him not playing was like kind of, it felt kind of wild. It also, though, feels kind of weird that he's on this Kings team. So we'll get to that in a second. All right. First off, just top line numbers. Russ last season, 13.3 points, 6.1 assists, 4.9 rebounds, and 1.4 steals in just under 28 minutes a game for the Nuggets. So like Russ can still produce given the opportunity to play significant minutes. He came off the bench for about half of those games or a little more than half of those games. Got 4 third place votes for sixth man of the year, which I'm not sure that the like plus minus advanced numbers necessarily bore that out. And a lot of the bonus, we've talked about this before, it's the halo effect of playing with Nikola Jokic. But either way, Russ produced and he had moments. He was really good in that first round series against the Clippers when they eliminated his former team, the Clippers. Less so in the second round against the Thunder when Russ shot 34.8% from the field, 21.9% from 3-point range and had more turnovers than assists. He played 160 minutes against Oklahoma City in the second round and the Nuggets got outscored by 92 points in those minutes, which is pretty tough.
Do we worry about that with the Kings, that his postseason performance is going to be lacking?
I don't know if that's like the silver lining around the gray cloud or if that's the gray cloud within the silver lining. But like, yeah, we might not have to worry too much about the beam breaking through the gray cloud into the postseason this year. For what it's worth, he also he had hand surgery. He had two broken bones in his shooting hand after the season. He had that, repaired it. And now apparently, you know, good to go. He's, according to Shams, expected to officially join the team later this week. When he gets there, he will join a backcourt that already features Dennis Schroeder, Zach LaVine, Malik Monk, Keon Ellis, Devin Carter, who was a first round pick a couple years ago.
Who leads the team in assists?
Domantas Sabonis, right? I'm gonna guess the center.
So who of all the teams in the NBA that we do this thing of like there's only one ball? Yeah. I feel like the loudest team that has to answer that question of like there's so many mouths to feed. There's one basketball and you're adding Russell Westbrook to this equation here. Like there's so many ball dominant guys on this team that I'm just like, wait a minute. Of all the teams, I just don't see how he's going to get enough oxygen to be able to thrive here.
Especially, yeah, if you are looking to maximize the investments you've made over, you know, in Dennis Schroeder in free agency, Zach LaVine in trade a couple years ago, Devin Carter in the with a first round pick, you know, what you've put into the roster so far, it does feel like this would be kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul. And it also feels like it doesn't address what feels like the biggest problem on the Kings roster right now, which is the Kings really had one legit like perimeter defender, big wing kind of guy, Keegan Murray, and he's hurt. He tore the ulnar collateral ligament in his left thumb during a loss to the Portland Trailblazers and is going to be reevaluated 4 to 6 weeks, probably going to miss the first 10 plus games of the regular season, if not longer. And so now you're like, are we starting a three guard lineup with Zach LaVine as like your nominal small forward? And who's guarding fours? Is DeMar DeRozan guarding your best perimeter guy?
Like you talked about backcourt, and that doesn't include DeMar DeRozan and Domantas Sabonis, who like, these guys need the ball in their hands to operate. Yeah, Sabonis can do some off-ball stuff, offensive rebounding, and DeMar can make some cuts. But, like, where's Russell Westbrook going to touch the ball in this situation? And if you were thinking Russell Westbrook was a good addition, why wait 2 days before the season starts with no training camp to integrate him into the roster? And the timing with Keegan Murray, can you name another player who is more dissimilar to Keegan Murray than Russell Westbrook?
Yeah, it's not easy. And I mean, it feels like, you know, your concerns about the offense are well-founded and I think legitimate. I think the bigger problem is I don't know how this team defends anybody if you're going to have Sabonis on the court a ton, and Sabonis obviously plays a ton. He's barely misses time. You know, plays through like torn stuff in his thumb and injuries and all, and he's great. but he's not a rim protector. They've not been a great defensive team with him at the back line. You are playing probably DeMar and LaVine at the 3-4 spots. Schroeder can be a real pass at the point of attack. Keon Ellis is a fantastic defender, has, you know, had his moments where, like, you know, he ran afoul of Mike Brown and was in and out of the lineup. And maybe it's just like Keon Ellis, go guard everybody. But wing bigger guys, I don't know how exactly that's going to work out. And like, I mean, yeah, like the second line, the reserve courts, like, is Doug McDermott and Drew Eubanks and Dario Saric going to be kind of it feels like there's a lot of guys. I don't know that there's a cohesive thought process here in terms of how it all fits together to get stops against NBA offenses, or to, as you mentioned, like, space the floor properly and generate good looks against NBA defenses. It just feels a little bit more like somebody building like a fantasy basketball roster, or like I know that guy's good, so let's get him in here. But does it make sense in the context of what you already have? I have a lot of questions about that. And maybe I'm being overly pessimistic and Doug Christie's got a great sense of how he's going to make this all work. It feels like kind of a lot of mismatched ingredients, and I'm not sure that the resultant meal is going to be all that tasty.
I want Devin Carter and Keon Ellis to have like the bulk of those minutes in the backcourt this season. I want to see what Devin Carter can do. Keon on this show, just like, I love what this dude brings to the table, especially with the complementary role that he provides with the rest of the guys who need the ball in their hands to thrive. You need more Keon Ellis's, and I just worry that this is not a good fit for Russ. I worry about that with this acquisition. I'm happy for Russell Westbrook that he gets this deal, but I just don't know where he fits in with this roster that is just... I don't understand it. But hey, the Kings will king. You know, that's how they do. Dan, I feel like we've got a pretty good season preview, big number episode here, because we went all over the place here with this in about an hour. So, I should say this. He didn't play for the Sonics. He just was drafted by the Sonics, wore the green and yellow Seattle hat with David Stern. But it always throws me off that he didn't actually play for the Sonics because they had already moved to OKC by then, who also drafted Domantas Sabonis, by the way, his new teammate. And also Dennis Schroeder and Russell Westbrook played together with the Lakers, where Russ was backing up Dennis Schroeder on that ill-fated season. So hopefully it turns out better for Russ and the Sacramento Kings.
Yeah, yeah. The Kings, just to put a button on them, they're over under at BetMGM's 35.5. And I don't imagine that this is going to move that needle significantly forward. It feels like a team that is, in the best case scenario, fighting for like the 10 spot out West. And, you know, Russ has been in situations where his like, the ability to play, to get downhill, to get you in transition, to speed things up, like, there's value in that. And plenty of big game experience, the tenacity, like the attitude, there's things to love about him as a competitor. Even at this point, he played off Jokic. Maybe that helps him play off a similarly styled hub player in Sabonis, and, you know, made some more corner threes, was more weaponized as a cutter, like did some of those things that you would need him to do to not be ball dominant. It's just a question of how additive all that is at this stage, and how additive it is for a Kings team that I think is more likely to be kind of scuffling around that bottom of the play-in mix. But it'll be weird to see him in a new uniform, but maybe less weird than not seeing him at all. So that there's something to be said for that.
I think he's trying to play for every team in the Western Conference. OKC.
He's not leaving the West. He wants to stay. Those flights need to be short.
Mm-hmm. OKC, Houston, Lakers, Denver, next Clippers. On the list.
Clippers, he was at.
Yep. Clippers. I mean, yeah. Collect the whole set. Might as well. Why not?
Why not?
There we are. And scene. thank you, Emmy, so much. Thank you, all listeners. Thank you for producing this show, Emmy. Hey, if you want to move the needle, subscribe, rate, review, give us 5 stars. And go tell your friends, go tell your buddies, and also go check us out, yahoosports.tv on the Fast Channel. Go check it out. Thanks so much, and we'll do this again next week.